really in the position of running a public utility. What they wanted to do was run their own defense network, but they wanted to do some research around construction of networks, which is how ARPANET came to be, but they weren't in the business of running a public utility. So they transitioned control of the proto-internet to the National Science Foundation, or NSF. And this became the NSFNet. So it was largely academic and research. It's, unfortunately, this graphic doesn't scale, but that shows you how old it is, because that's the only kind of graphics I can get that are of that poor resolution. But as you can see, it's still based around the continental United States, and you're linking together research and academic sites. There were terms of use for NSFNet that explicitly forbade commercial activity and even strongly discouraged excessive personal use by the researchers and so on who were using it, like personal email and that kind of thing. Obviously, by 1995, this was rather untenable because so many people wanted to use it for commercial purposes. So they transitioned to the commercial internet, which is the internet as we know it today, in the mid-90s. And NSFNet was eventually shut off. So what quickly happened was, you got this club, you could call it, of tier one ISPs who formed a complete mesh of direct connections between each other. So if you look back at the older networks, it wasn't quite a complete mesh. You might be, for example, Houston, Texas. You only have three direct links, but you can get to New York, you can get to Cambridge, Massachusetts via other parties. What quickly emerged in the commercial internet was the notion of this complete mesh at the core of the internet. And this was because if you're any one of these tier one players and you have a link to every other tier one player, then by definition, you can route traffic anywhere on the internet without paying anybody else. You have a path to everywhere on the internet through your own physical infrastructure and then through other tier one ISPs. Now, it's not actually the whole internet, it's a region. So a tier one provider is considered to be one within a region, aka a country, that has a route to every address in that country through its own infrastructure or through peers in the Tier 1 club. Of course, this kind of situation is going to lead to an oligarchy, which is exactly what happened. So this is an incomplete list of the Tier 1 providers in North America, but in every country they have these oligarchies. Australia has one, everywhere has one. Actually, there's one interesting exception to the Tier 1 oligarchy, which is Vanuatu. And the national telecommunications, sort of nationalized government-owned telecommunications company there, had a complete monopoly. And then all of the other players, the commercial players that started coming into the space, all peered with each other, but won't peer with the incumbent provider. So you basically have two separate internets there. Everywhere else you have a tier one club. So what do the rest of us peasants do? We buy an internet transit service, which is basically a port in the wall that says internet this way. It's a single connection that gives you a route anywhere on the internet. And so again, if you go all the way back here, there are some outposts, Salt Lake City, Utah, for example, where they just have one link to Boulder, Colorado, and then eventually their traffic will be routed everywhere else. That's effectively what we have with internet transit services. You go to Dodo, Telstra, Optus, whoever, you buy some bandwidth, and this could be in a residential or commercial setting, or even within a data center. You're just buying transit to anywhere on the internet. And transit is a metered service. So when you buy it in a residential situation, it's usually a bit more complex. You get traffic shaping and so on. But at the high end, at the commercial level, if you go into a data center and you say, I want 1 gigabit, 10 gigabit of transit service, you're actually paying for that being metered at the 95th percentile of usage. So whatever the 95th percentile of average usage, whatever that amount of bandwidth was over the month, that's the amount that you're billed for. So takeaway message is, the more you use, the more you pay. Also, other people completely control the routing of your traffic. You have no control over it because your router only has one route that says, go to my transit provider. So who does control routing? How does it actually work? Well, it's a bit of a mystery, but the very short version is, today this is almost entirely handled by BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol. So BGP is kind of like an open market. BGP speakers, or route reflectors, can advertise routes that they provide and say, I provide access to the following IP addresses or prefixes. So, blocks of network address space. And then they say, this is how many hops it will take if you use me to get to that target. And the only thing that is taken into account when determining, well, there can be manual overrides, but the only thing that's automatically taken into account when determining how to route traffic is the hop count, right? So if you want, and you're able to send BGP announcements to other people, you could come in and say, oh, the best route everywhere is through me. It's just one hop or two hops. And then you'll hijack that traffic and have it pass through you. This happens every single day on the internet. And there's been some really fascinating incidents recently. One of the problems is it's impossible to tell whether it was accidental or intentional. BGP is complex, and there's lots of ways that people could accidentally announce favorable routes and start routing traffic through them. But there's also a lot of ways that people could do it on purpose, and it's hard to tell. If you have a look at that link from the Washington Post, that gives you a really good overview of some of the incidents that happened today with BGP hijacking. So anyway, that was just a little bit of background. This is a security talk. What are the security concerns inherent in using an internet transit service? Well, the first one is just targeted DDoS where you're the target, right? So you only have one route to the internet. If that link gets saturated, that's it. You're off the internet. So I hope people can see there which button is it for later? Yeah. That red, anything in these diagrams coming up that's red is going to mean that it's saturated or compromised. Not just DDoS targeting you, but also background DDoS on the network can be a problem. Consider this case, where you've got a bunch of DDoS attackers out here, and they're hitting this DDoS target. Now, you as the customer wish to hit the customer target. This is the destination address for your traffic. And to get there, you have to transit some other ISP, which also has the DDoS target attached to it. Now, if the link between your transit provider and that provider is saturated, you can't get to your target, even though that wasn't the target of the DDoS attack. So this background DDoS noise could be a real problem for you. Now, for a lot of people, it's not such a big deal. Okay, the performance sucks a little bit. It's a problem. For some people, it's a really serious problem. If you run a gaming platform, if you run Netflix, then your business lives and dies on whether or not you have high-performant, responsive links to all of your customers. Of course, the other threat is man in the middle. If you know you just route all traffic through one port and you have no idea where it goes after that, n number of people could be man in the middle attacking you, and there's absolutely nothing you could do about it. Or what you could do is set up a direct connection to your target. So in this case, you're just saying, we'll get to what it physically consists of in a minute, but logically, you have a direct network connection to your target. You don't have to go through the tier 1 ISPs. You don't have to go through your transit provider. And no matter what's happening up here in the public internet, you have a direct link to that target. This happens today, and it's commonly called peering, or internet peering. Another alternative term is interconnection, which is becoming more popular. And today, it's typically done manually. And it's quite an onerous task. I've been to a few of these peering conferences in the US, and it's a very interesting scene. So I went to one recently that was 4 days for the whole conference, and the speaking track consisted of 4 hours of talks, single track. And all the rest was meeting time, basically a big piss-up. And so the idea is that peering coordinators from all of these big providers get together, have a good time, and determine whether or not they wish to set up a direct connection between each other. If they do, they'll manually provision a cross-connect, which is a physical cable from one rack in the data center to another rack. Then they'll manually configure the switches and routers in their racks, and up it comes. And this relies on anybody who's going to participate in the peering or interconnection ecosystem having skilled engineers, costs a lot of money, niche technical skills, sending people around to these peering coordination conferences. It doesn't scale very well. Also, there's a long indeterminate lead time to actually provisioning an interconnection. So an alternative is software-defined interconnection, or SDI. And the idea is, I'm not speaking about any specific SDI implementation here, just the idea in general. The idea is that you negotiate an interconnection agreement online somehow. For example, there's now a thing called PeeringDB, which is a public database of people who may wish to participate in interconnection agreements. You can go in there, look up people's details, find out what their prerequisites are to be able to peer with you, send them an email. You can do that online. To be able to automatically provision a cross-connect, this isn't really 100% necessary in all cases because you may already have a connection into a shared switch, but if you don't, you're going to need to provision a cross-connect from the data center. You want to automatically configure the switches and routers. And if you can automate all of that, then each person who's participating in this ecosystem doesn't rely on any of those niche specialist skills. So what does an implementation look like? This is a typical internet exchange point. This is how people implement peering today for the most part. So you'll have a large data center or POP, point of presence. And in there, you'll have an internet exchange switch. So in Australia, there's a whole bunch of them. WAX run a bunch of them. It's basically a small entity that operates some simple network infrastructure and allows you to connect to it and then use that connection to peer with somebody else. So there's an IX. The IX has to already have some sort of presence in that data center. And customer A and customer B have to already have some presence in that data center. But today, they'd be accessing each other via transit. The software-defined interconnection platform could automatically push a VLAN tag down to the switch to say, okay, we're going to isolate the traffic from these two. The cross-connects could be automatically provisioned, so they're physically connected. And then BGP routes could be advertised and pushed down to those routers saying, in order to customer A, in order to get to all of customer B's addresses, go through here, vice versa, and now that you're no longer using the transit link, but you still have that transit link up. You're just bypassing it for traffic between customer A and B. Now, if you take this to its logical conclusion, what you wind up with is not just the tier one club, but the interconnection club. Well, to put it another way, the tier ones have an oligarchy that you can't join. They are strongly disincentivized to let you join the tier one club because it undermines their business. But there's nothing stopping you going and creating your own club. And this is what we're starting to see people do. At the larger IXPs, internet exchange points, such as AMSIX in Amsterdam and Lynx in London, there are hundreds of people connected to a couple of switches there, and you'll start to see a mesh emerge, where it's not just one person peering with another, that each person is peering with multiple other people at that exchange, and this mesh is emerging where they're bypassing transit altogether for communication. So what are the security benefits of that? Yeah, it's cool, it's lower latency, it's probably cheaper because you're not paying per meg for a transit service. But from a security perspective, why should you care? Consider a few scenarios. The first one, a straight up DDoS. Now this could be the kind of amplification DDoS that Wiley was talking about or anything else, it doesn't matter. But consider you have some attackers out here and they're all connected to different transit providers. Eventually this traffic gets aggregated towards the target. And by the time it gets there, the link between the transit provider and the target is saturated, right? So if this target wanted to communicate with anybody else in the outside world, it couldn't because its transit link is saturated. But if it wanted to communicate with anybody else with whom it has a direct interconnection, no problem. All those links are not affected at all by the DDoS. Now, that works for both targeted DDoS and background DDoS. Nobody else is impacted by that either. So long as they're in the interconnection club, so to speak. Something that's coming up, there's a lot of research happening around this, there's quite a few open source projects that are prototyping this, and if anybody's interested, I can give you some pointers, is the idea of distributed DDoS mitigation in this sort of environment. So the idea is, now that people are all talking to each other, and they're no longer just buying a transit service and saying internet this way, the routers could also not just share routes via BGP, but share information about live DDoS attacks. So this little black dot here is meant to indicate a black hole. So what's happening is the DDoS target has identified via some algorithm or monitoring that it's being DDoSed. It's identified a fingerprint of the traffic and it black holes it there. Okay, that kind of helps, but not really. What it really wants to do is say to its upstream link, hey, this particular traffic fingerprint is a DDoS attack, you should block it too. It blackholes it, and this message keeps getting passed on until the attack is blackholed as close to the source as possible. And this is something that people are starting to roll out in production today. And you no longer need volumetric mitigation. You can just push it back to the source. Again, with the man-in-the-middle scenario, same thing. You could have an MITM attacker out here in the path between you and the transit provider or beyond the transit provider, and that's still a problem for any traffic that's traversing transit, but for any traffic that's between directly connected peers, it has no effect at all. So, how do you implement this stuff? Obviously, this is catering to people that have some pretty significant networking infrastructure, but in terms of implementing a SDI platform, as I've just outlined it, what tools are available to you? I think this is one of the areas where open source is just completely leading the way. I don't think you could do this without using open source tools. There are no commercial SDI tools that really do any of this stuff well. There's two approaches, though. The first is relying on traditional converged data and control plane networking devices. So this is where you go to some big vendor, your Juniper, your Cisco, your Brocade, whatever vendor of choice it is, and you just buy a standard kit from them for your switches and routers. Then you could use Cumulus Linux on your switches if you wanted. That's a bit of an edge case. Then you can use open source software, such as Bird and Quagga, to advertise routes, advertise BGP routes on behalf of your customers. And you could actually push the configuration down to the switches and routers just by using whatever programmatic admin interfaces they already provide. So all the major vendors provide either a proprietary API or something standards-based like NetConf. So you could just write some code that generates an XML file that is pushed over SSH via NetConf or something to the device saying, set up this VLAN tag between port 1 and port 2 and advertise these BGP routes via Bird or Quagga. And that would work just fine. That has some advantages, because all of the components that I just mentioned are quite mature, quite stable. Bird is a bugbear for me, and this is a call to action, by the way, for anybody in the room. As I said, I used to work for Red Hat, and some really smart guys there were really good at memory corruption attacks. No one can find a vulnerability in Bird. No one. And I want to find one. I've spent, seriously, dozens of hours on it. Can't find a thing, not even a denial of service. So there's got to be something in there. Somebody please help me. But no one's ever found a single vulnerability. And I contacted the developers and said, have you guys ever shipped a security patch? And they said, no, because there's never been a vulnerability in the code. It's over 10 years old. So that's pretty good. It's pretty stable. It also allows you to leverage existing skills. So if you have NetOps guys who are familiar with Dollar's big vendor's kit, no problem. You can keep using it. And the stable APIs and configuration interfaces. This is how most SDI platforms operate today. So there's a few SDI platforms in the world that are operable today. One is the Snap platform, built by Allegro Networks in the UK, which is owned by IIX. Another is Megaport, which is based out of Brisbane. And another is PacNet. We'll get to PacNet in a minute. The alternative approach is to go full-blown SDN, software-defined networking. So rather than relying on traditional networking gear, say, while we're at it, let's use this to make the transition to software-defined networking. So what this means is your switches are dumb devices, pure data plane devices, and all the control plane logic is factored out to an SDN controller. The SDN controller tells the switches exactly how to forward packets based on rules that it defines. And most SDN controllers, OpenDaylight, NOS, ONOS being the two big ones, also include a BGP server. So it's a one-stop shop. You could take OpenDaylight or ONOS and have it do the whole thing for you. It would require a fair bit of duct tape or chicken wire, but it would just be one piece of software running the whole thing. There's also another project called SDX, Software Defined Internet Exchange, but it's a bit less mature. So both of these projects, OpenDaylight and ONOS, are open source. They're both backed by really big vendors. Interestingly, OpenDaylight is backed by all the traditional big vendors in the US, Red Hat, Brocade, Cisco, Juniper, I think, AT&T, a whole bunch of them. ONOS is backed by Huawei, the three major telcos in China, and Cisco. It's really interesting, really interesting split there. Anyway, are they stable and are they secure? This, unfortunately, is not going to be a very legible slide. I apologize. Put this one together in a little bit of a rush. But I'll tell you the story. So when I started to look at OpenDaylight and ONOS in December 2014, I thought, okay, do they have a security response function? Has anybody audited the code? Have they ever shipped any security patches? And I started to dig around, and I found that this guy, Gregory Pickett from Hellfire, had dropped some OpenDaylight Zero Day on the full disclosure list back in September, and no one had responded to it at all. And I contacted him and said, why did you drop it on full disclosure? And he said, because there was nowhere to report it. There was no other way. He didn't drop an exploit. It was just a report of the vulnerability. And the vulnerability was just the standard XXE flaw, XML external entity flaw, but it was against an unauthenticated interface, so it was essentially a remote code execution flaw. And this just sat there, with nobody ever responding to the report. So in December, I founded the Open Daylight Security Response Team. We shipped the patch. There was a whole lot of media hullabaloo about it. And things are a lot better now on Open Daylight. What about ONOS? Well, they came to the party a little bit later. They didn't actually ship any code until December. And so by then I was able to say, hey guys, you just shipped some code, you really need a security response function or else this will happen to you too. So they didn't have so much of a mess. But what they did have was a really interesting vulnerability discovered by one of their own developers. And apparently he'd been sitting on this for a while as just a bug, and then after speaking it through, realized it was a serious security issue. Now again, you're not really going to be able to read it, and I apologize for that. But the idea is that these OpenFlow-enabled switches are just dumb devices. They just forward packets based on the rules given to them, and the SDN controller controls everything. And it should, in any decent deployment, be off in a secure, isolated network. Because if you control the SDN controller, you control the whole network, right? So all the best practices say just make sure that it's isolated and secure. This vulnerability, though, exploits the fact that if an OpenFlow-enabled switch encounters a packet that it doesn't know what to do with, it forwards it to the SDN controller and says, I don't know what to do with this packet. And the bug was that there was a flaw in the deserializer of the packet. So you'd construct an intentionally malformed packet, send it through the data plane of an OpenFlow-enabled switch. It would say, I don't know what to do with this. Push it up to the SDN controller, ONOS, and then ONOS would not be able to handle it properly. It would throw an exception. If they failed to properly catch that exception, so the exception would bubble all the way up to the top-level exception handler, which said, the switch to which I am attached is completely broken. I'm going to disconnect it from the network. So you could just packet of death a switch, and the SDN controller would disconnect it from the rest of the network. Very cool vulnerability. And really interesting because it changes the conversation about the attack surface of SDN controllers. So I mentioned PACnet, and this is public information, so I'm only calling it out because it's all public in press releases and so on. PACnet is owned by Telstra, by the way. And they're speaking at the Open Daylight Summit in July this year, and they've come out and said, our entire product is built on Open Daylight in production. And interestingly enough, these two guys here, I did a little bit of stalking. One of them is from Kazakhstan, the other one is from Russia. They both work for Mirantis, and they seem to have implemented the entire thing. So very interesting. The whole PACnet SDI platform is today, you know, running on SDN, running on Open Daylight. Oops. I think I've lost my clicker. Can you forward me a slide? I think there's only a couple left. There's only one more left before questions.
Shine a laser at it, please, does it?
Hey, there we go. Okay, so the final bit is just a plug for the Cloud Router project. This is something that I've been working on with some of my colleagues, and it's just an open source project that's a distribution of all of the technologies that I've been talking about. So some of these things like Bird or Quagga, you can get packages in Debian or Fedora, but a lot of this stuff isn't easily accessible in one spot. So we've got a Linux distribution built on Fedora that includes Bird, Quagga, Open Daylight, ONOS. You can download that as a disk image. We've also got Docker images, OSV images, Rocket images. And it's a collaborative community project trying to make it easier for people to consume the software that goes into building an SDI platform. And that's it. Any questions?
Damn. You're pretty well, actually. Have you looked at actually integrating this with enterprise-grade stuff like, say, Nexus or Flex or anything that, you know, people with actual money are going to have with regards to software-defined networks?
No, not really. I think because this is really building new infrastructure. And, yeah, the idea is that we want to make a break from a lot of the legacy vendors. Any other questions? No? Okay, well thank you very much for coming everybody and hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.